Welcome back to the Why We Fight 1943 podcast, designed to accompany the social media series of the same name. I'm Sasha, and if you've listened to the previous episodes, you likely noticed that this one started a little differently. After careful consideration, I decided to change the music for certain episodes. For the time being, meaning unless I find an alternative I feel better fits, the music you just heard will be used for episodes in which my guests talk about the bad guys. This could be the Nazis, this could be the Axis in general, but since the subjects can get pretty dark at times, and some members of the audience may be sensitive to the topics discussed, I wanted to add a sort of audible trigger warning so that listeners know that this episode will be a little bit different. So far, the episodes are not graphic, but because the subjects can be darker, I felt like a trigger warning would be appreciated. I will also put a trigger warning in the episode description, but I know that most people probably don't read those. I certainly don't read them for every episode of podcasts that I listen to. My guest today is Dr. Philip Blood, and we recorded for a long time the Saturday before last. So I'm dividing the episode into two parts. In the first part, Dr. Blood will talk about 1943 in general, how he sees the state of things at that time, and he will pay particular attention to the Nazis because this is his area of expertise. We do get on and off subject a few times, but all of the discussion is connected. And we do have a few humorous moments, which can help when covering difficult topics such as these. I know for me personally, humor is my coping mechanism of choice. In the second episode, he talks about the Luftwaffe operating in a forest in Poland that I still can't pronounce correctly. My guest today is Dr. Philip Blood, an independent historian and researcher and the author of a couple of books, including Hitler's Bandit Hunters, the SS and the Nazi Occupation of Europe, and the more recent Birds of Prey, Hitler's Luftwaffe, Ordinary Soldiers in the Holocaust in Poland. Philip, welcome to the Why We Fight 1943 podcast.
Thank you, Sasha. It's very pleasing to be here on a Saturday afternoon.
I'm glad you could be here too. Philip, why don't we start with just talking about 1943 in general and how you see it? And I mean, you've written some interesting books that include the topics that we'll talk about today. So,
well, for me, 1943 is the last chance for Germany to hold on to the strategic initiative, and very quickly they lose the strategic initiative through a series of serious and well-known decisive battles like Stalingrad and Kursk. So the history's all there, but the way it's been written in the past, it's always come from mostly the Allied perspective. And to a certain extent, what I've wanted to do is try to truly understand the war the Germans were fighting. So that's not the war that General Eisenhower wrote about later, his war. This is how the Germans responded to him and others. So my books are from a very German perspective, and my research has always been set towards understanding what the Germans are trying to do. In 1943, there's a whole lot of confusion. It's a ball of confusion with a few decisive people who appear to think they know what they're doing, and a few other people who know what they're doing, and then a whole range of idiots who absolutely don't know what they're doing and aren't going to do anything clever. And in this mash, certain things come out. So, for instance, I know people from the military side like to know that, you know, you've got all these new technical weapons, like the Tiger tanks come on stream, the panzer divisions are changed, the infantry divisions, are, a few of them are semi-motorized, turned into panzer grenadier divisions. There appears to be a reconstruction, reformation of the German army and the fighting units. And at the same time, similar operations are taking place in the rear areas. That's all because they're trying to maximize the swagger, the plunder that they steal from the occupation zones, and make the fighting units thin out to absorb the losses which they've been taking. So you've got a period in 1943, as I say, it's the last chance for the Germans to hold on to the strategic initiative, which they've had since 1939. A lot of it's illusionary. For instance, I have to say this very carefully because people take it the wrong way. The fact that Britain isn't occupied is in itself a huge strategic loss, because it means the Germans can't dominate the other side of the Atlantic, i.e. not the American side of the Atlantic, the West European side of the Atlantic. There's this platform, like an aircraft carrier in the sea, which is preventing the Germans, and they're having to go around the flanks of Britain to stop the convoys or other factors in the war. So they've made a loss there, and in the Mediterranean they've lost a certain amount of possibility to project power, because Malta hasn't fallen. If you have Malta, you can continue to project power, because you can just send the convoys across. Having the Royal Air Force and other air forces in that area intercepting, and the ships intercepting the convoys and the supply routes and the airborne troops coming in, Rommel isn't able to project the kind of power that he initially had when he first arrived in the desert in 41. It's a similar situation on the Eastern Front. The German forces have been thinned out because of the losses, and it appears they've absorbed the line, because taking up the slack, you've been able to move troops up the line and reorganize it. So although you've got this bulge at the bottom where there's Stalingrad and going on further, all of that's now gone. You've been able to reform the defensive line and fill the gaps with troops. And at the same time, in the homeland, the Germans are conducting, it's more like a rationalization of manpower, but it's very odd, because, for instance, all the flak units which have been defending the German cities, they're re-rationalized with the idea of putting children, 15-year-olds, teenagers, on the guns, the Hitler Youth, the young ladies from the I've forgotten the name for a minute, but it's a similar to BDM. And those youngsters take over a large bulk of flak activities. And it's not just handling the guns, it's all the signals and the relays and the supply side. That relieves an awful lot of manpower. And the unit that I'm going to talk about today, which we'll do a little bit in a minute, they're a beneficiary of these troops who have been released from the home front. And Germany's turning. A lot of people say, well, Goebbels has given a speech on the 18th of February, which is the famous total war speech. What everybody forgets with that is it is total war, but as the other part of the message is, at a pretty steady rate. And so they're not all suddenly going crazy. They're saying, well, we are going to total war, but, you know, we're going to do it at our pace. We're not going to do it at other people's pace. And at the same time, there's this notion where you'd think the Nazis have been saying it anyway, but they have and they haven't, which is we're now in people's war. And on the 30th of January, on the 10th anniversary of the Nazi Party, Goering gets up and gives his speech in which he talks about the people's Wehrmacht fighting the people's war. So before the defeat of Stalingrad, there's been a whole process of change, thinking about the future, reassessing the strategic requirements and redirection. And a lot of it started probably in August, which you don't see because it's very much in the background. You know, we know in August 1942, there's certain vehicles, certain equipment, certain troops coming along, and many of them are getting sucked into the Stalingrad campaign. But there's also preparations elsewhere for different troops, different actions. And then, you know, we're in 43, and suddenly Hitler has to face the reality of defeat in Stalingrad, while at the same time planning for the next phase of the war. And a lot of that gets missed when people study the war, because they, how can I put it? You get to Stalingrad, it's an end point. Well, it's not. People have imagined it was an end point, and for the next 6 months, the Germans sat around wondering, what the hell are we going to do now? Defeat's round the corner. Well, that's not exactly what they're doing. And almost within days, months of what's happened in Stalingrad, you're into major operations again and campaigns. And Hitler builds up his forces for the Kursk offensive, which, you know, we know he loses out there. But the fact of the matter is, you haven't had a period of stopping. Now, for me, that's quite interesting, because what is that doing to German society? What's that doing to the condition of the German soldiers? And they are suffering all forms of tensions, stresses. The bombing campaign's becoming really quite psychologically pressurizing the front soldiers. If you read most of the letters, it's about what's going on at home. There's a listening organization in Britain that's picking up the messages, and they can hear and they can read Germans talking about the bombing as a social issue. You know, so you get on the tram.
The bombing in Germany.
who survived today. Yes, the bombing in Germany.
Okay.
And the security organizations of the Third Reich, the Nazi security organizations, they're picking up on that too. So you've got all these added stresses. And in this mix, as I said, there's those people who don't know what they're doing and those who do and those who've never had an idea of what's been going on from the beginning. And several of the individuals who are very key at this point, Goering, Goebbels, Hitler, Himmler. Now, they've been very important for different reasons all the way up until this point. At this point, they all start to be committed, deeply committed to Hitler and winning the war, which you'd think, well, wasn't that what they were doing before? Well, actually, no, because they're all running around with their own agendas and plans. So, you know, Himmler was getting very much involved in the extermination of the Jews. There was also his great ambition to get access to control of all security areas and security activities in the occupied zones. And he's trying to turn the war into not just the three fronts, as it was then, the Eastern Front, the desert, the Navy. He's trying to get into four or five fronts with controlling the home front and controlling the occupation zones. Goering, he's got his ambitions and his agenda, partly to maintain the independence of the Luftwaffe. So you've got this very unusual situation that the Luftwaffe is part of the Wehrmacht, but it's an independent organization. And many historians have missed the fact that the Luftwaffe is not just another arm of the Wehrmacht. It's actually very independent and very Nazi, which, of course, a lot of people find very difficult because we've been led to believe that the history of the Luftwaffe was much more up in the clouds and never on the ground. Well, that's not the case. In fact, if you look at Luftwaffe manpower, at some points you can actually argue for every airman or aircrew, there's up to 10 who are on the ground. And then if you take it another way, it's 25 to 1. If you take it another way, it's nearly 75 to 1. And then by the time they've got, you know, the Panzer divisions, which, you know, to a lot of people seems very odd that an Air Force would have Panzer divisions.
Yeah.
But the ratios are all over the place. And that causes instability in the thinking process because you're dealing with an organization which isn't what you think it is. And the aviation, you know, the agenda when Goering sits down in his hunting lodge with his mini chiefs of staff and staff meetings, aviation is a tiny part. Now imagine that. You're in the middle of this huge war and there's one section, aviation warfare, subsection fighters, subsection bombers, subsection naval operations, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes on to forestry, hunting, German frontiers, German ownership of land, art, the acquisition of art and culture war across the whole of Europe. It goes on and on. So Goering's agenda is huge. And the other thing in all of this with Goering is he's Hitler's number two. And those two have played Tweedledum and Tweedledee since the 20s. Yeah. Everyone says, you know, you've got this very fat, rich bloke befriending this very poor, skinny bloke, and what's going on there? And they're both sides of the same coin. So there's this idea that somehow Goering isn't a Nazi. He's probably more Nazi at times than Hitler. There's this idea that Hitler's very anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic, and wants the Jews part of the war plan. Well, Goering doesn't, which is not true either, because although Goering was brought up by a Jewish godfather and was taught to hunt and live and become a medievalist with his godfather, he was ravenously anti-Semitic, worse to a certain extent than Hitler. And of course, he writes a letter to Himmler saying, we need a final solution of the Jews in July 1941. And within days of that being written, his forester troops commit mass exterminations in Poland. So the whole story has a different trajectory than perhaps has been written and perhaps assumed. And for me, the peak of that moment is 1943. So I hope that kind of gives us a bit of a background to what's happened in 43 and how I see it.
It's very helpful. Question, the troops that were on the Eastern Front, I read somewhere, and I can't remember where I read it, which is typical of me, should have written it down, that those troops were more or less rotated through, like, to France and back to try to ease some of the strain from the high op tempo that they were dealing with.
Well, essentially, without being specific about certain units and what have you, if a division, let's say a Panzer division, gets trashed, and they get trashed all the time, so, you know, and I'm talking about seriously trashed. So if you're looking at something like, let me think, the 2nd SS Panzer Division gets trashed in Russia in 43, and it gets sent to 44, it gets sent to Normandy. I think at one point it's got 600 men, maybe 5 tanks. So it's sent there to rest and refit. They don't always have the time, but basically that's what started round about the end of the 1941 campaign, when the Germans are halted before Moscow. As they clean up the front lines into 42, early 42, a lot of the trashed units, and some of them are really, really mullered by extensive fighting for up to 3 or 4 months, they go to France, and some of them are in a dreadful condition. Of course, by 43, they start weeding out the hospitals for troops who are, quote, moderately wounded. We haven't got yet to the point where they've got those so-called stomach battalions, you know, they're so wounded they can barely move. But there is continual rationalization, and a certain amount of it takes place in France, but France isn't always the case. Some divisions come out of the line in Russia and never go further than Poland because they might need to be pushed into another sector. What the Germans do is they take the remains of a unit, a Kader, and then bolt on a whole load of units and then send it off as a division. And somewhere along the way, and no one's really understood how it works, I suppose, because I've never heard how it happens, those troops become a cohesive fighting unit, or so we're led to believe. I'm not convinced.
but then, no, it makes sense. I mean, the way that the U.S. Army trained in order to get the soldiers ready to deploy faster, because we were pulling in draftees as well as people that were volunteering, they would go through basic training and then they would do training like as a unit. And then once they got overseas, they would do more training as a unit.
Well, from August 1942, the Germans, Hitler introduces a doctrine called Bandenbekämpfung, which is where my Hitler's Bandit Hunters comes from. It's the doctrine to fight the partisans. And what they dream up as an idea is troops in basic training and operational training will get their first blooding and first confrontation with violence against partisans. Now, a lot of people would say, that's fairly brutal. And I'd say, well, that's the nature of the war you're fighting. But what you do by blooding troops so quickly is you get over the hurdle of somebody killing someone. Now, I know we're getting into some really deep, dark stuff, but the hurdle of getting troops to kill somebody is quite something. Because if the troops are reluctant, you know, you've got these arguments that Slam Marshall has had and others, that the American soldiers, 20% of them didn't fire or did fire, and all of those calculations during and after the Second World War, did the soldiers pull the trigger or not? What the Germans are doing is not so much whether you pull the trigger, it's whether you kill somebody. And if you've gone through that process of violent confrontation and you've come out fairly successfully, you are a very useful soldier to the German system. Hence why veterans get rotated quite a lot, because, you know, they're good for a unit. And you see these guys turning up, and boy, do they make a difference. The transformation is quite stunning. Just to say with my units, just taking, you know, you'd think that these basic troops who were in operational training, and as I will elaborate a bit later, that they committed heinous crimes, you'd think they were not fit for fighting. Yet when the main Russian offensive comes through in 44, these young men fight harder than I've ever imagined. And I couldn't at the time understand why. Eventually, it all pieced together and I could understand it. And a lot of it's to do with significant battle-hardened veteran NCOs who knew exactly what to do at the right moment. And their intuition of what the enemy was about to do was so remarkable. It just took me completely by surprise, because I'd heard this impression. I'd given this impression that somehow German soldiers could read the minds of the Russians. And I thought, really?
Yeah.
Kind of pull a face on that one. And then watching a senior sergeant hold a small unit together with barely any heavy weapons, destroying T-34s in large numbers and repulsing Russian offensives, you know, tactical, low-level, close combat fights was just amazing. It's not quite the Sergeant Steiner kind of story of Cross of Iron film in the 70s, but we're not too far away from it. And we see this emerging in 1943. And from my perspective, the brutal Nazi soldier is about to emerge, and it's happening now in 1943. It's changing situation where the dynamic in the mindset of the German soldier is, we're being bombed, we got the backs to our against the wall because we're fighting everybody. There's a Jewish conspiracy. There's always a Jewish conspiracy. The communists are trying to take over the world and cleanse us of our culture. And surprisingly, they would say, you know, the Führer knows best. You know, we believe in the Führer, he's our man. And that twisted into a combat situation, a fighting situation where the German soldier is expected to hold his ground, leads to a different kind of brutal warfare. Up until, I don't know, up until the Kasserine Pass action, where the Americans confront a very aggressive German army, I don't even think the British army had met that kind of aggression. Then when the Brits and the Americans land in Sicily, they start meeting this kind of committed fighters. And in that mix, you get things happening, like the Hermann Göring soldiers commit the crimes in the Benghazi British military hospital. And on the Eastern Front, okay, they're not starving the Russian soldiers as they had done in 1941, but you know, the intention of taking prisoners is still very, very low. In Yugoslavia, the bandit fighting, the anti-partisan operations, which they're not, they're worse than that, because they're eradicating whole villages. So it's a genocidal operation. Troops are being rotated through that, and they're very quickly being taught how to destroy a village. It's very interesting when people talk about the 2nd SS Panzer Division in 44 going through southern France, and it destroys a village called Oradour-sur-Glon. It's very interesting how everybody kind of focuses on that and says, well, here's a division driving slowly up the road, doesn't get to France, it's supposed to be going to Normandy. You know, why does it spend its time destroying a village? My argument is, how does it destroy the village will determine why it's doing it. And because they've spent all day doing it, and they've done it with care and attention to make sure they kill the maximum number, and very few escape, and those who do escape are intended to get the message out there that this is happening. That's part of a routine. You've routinized, if you like, the brutal side of Nazi warfare. Now, okay, there's only a few cases like that on the Western Front. The killing of British and Canadian soldiers in Normandy, the Oradour-sur-Glon, the Malmedy incident. There's a few more littered around which don't always get picked up. But if you were to look at that in the East, that's like every day. I mean, we're talking about 11,000 villages in just Belarus being destroyed in 42, 43. So again, 1943 is a change. And it's not just the strategic, you know, the last attempt to retain the strategic initiative. It's raising the level of violence in the mindset of the German soldier down on the ground. That was gloomy, wasn't it?
It was, but you know what? This is important stuff, and it's stuff that I would have to dedicate more than twice what I already do to this series to be able to cover it by myself. So I need people like you to be able to help me tell these stories.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's truly important. Obviously,
it is important.
It's fairly gloomy. See, my concern with military history is we've gone down this route of making it very nice and sweet, and we're all heroes because we're British and American. We won the war.
Right.
Our destiny is to rule the world and blah, blah, blah. And unfortunately, you kind of squeeze out the pips, which happen to be the nasty bits, that war is not a very pleasant exercise. It causes incredible harm to people, as has happened in Ukraine at the moment. The remarkable thing about Ukraine, just to glance off for a second, is everybody can see what's happening in war, and still people are denying it's happening in war.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happened during the Second World War. I have a story where the British rabbi who went into Belsen to create service and bring succor to the victims and what have you in 1945. He was sat in the officers' mess, and two British officers walked in and said, yeah, it's all their own fault. These bloody Jews have caused nothing but trouble. Now, I mean, I don't think I could ever been so more astonished when I heard that story than the first time, but it's the same kind of, that kind of blaming game and accusing game and racial game that has been right the way through the 20th century, if not before, is re-emerging again in this conflict in the East. And okay, I don't like analogies with what's happening in Ukraine now, with what happened on the Eastern Front. But what I would say is race and brutal violence always end up in large numbers of people being murdered and killed or raped and looted and what have you. And that we always end up close to genocide or genocide, or we tip into genocide, which is what happened on the Eastern Front or in Yugoslavia, and to a certain extent in France. Mm-hmm. You know, what the Germans were doing to some French. You see, what people don't pick up with the Orador Seguin thing is the Nazis were at war with Catholicism. And by the SS putting people in a Catholic church and setting fire to it, they're actually abiding by Nazi dogma. Yeah. Goes back deep to the 1920s and 30s when the Nazis were, you know, having their culture wars against the Catholic Church.
I was going to say something. The comparison.
Too gloomy by me, it's put you off.
What I was going to say is when I started this, I had a few things in mind where, like, I know that the public education system across the U.S. is quite varied. And so not everybody learns this history. And if they do, they only learn key information, like major information. They don't learn that military history, right? Like war does not exist in a bubble. We are all affected by it. And so I try to work in the human stories as often as possible because I want people to see how these events are connected to literally everything. And they're still connected to what we're doing now, you know, in a military and doctrine sense, there's the connections in the geopolitical sense, there are connections. And so, but I wanted to avoid things like, you know, we get Pearl Harbor, the Americans are in it to win it. And that's what happens. We get in there and we win. That's not what happened. I want people to see, you know, that's also why I tried to take it, why I decided to take it 1 year at a time, because there's 11 months between the attack on Pearl Harbor and Operation Torch, you know, and that's a long time where, okay, now we're at war. That's 11 months of, you know, that's a long time between, and we had been preparing, so we were not prepared enough. Right. And then, and now we've got the people that know Pearl Harbor, Operation Torch, and then,
yep.
And then what, Normandy? That's not, you know, there's a lot that goes on in between there. So, and we don't often look at it from what were they doing? It wasn't just, you know, Hitler was bad and, you know, the Nazis killed a bunch of Jews. It's not that simple. We need to see what else was going on so that we can understand, but also so that we can recognize these behaviors when we start to see them in history again.
Yeah, I think it's very important for historians to be, I don't know, I'm not sure it's the right word, but to be a little bit responsible with what they do.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I'm the first published historian who's actually written a book on the crimes of the Luftwaffe. Now, what was going through my mind at the time, and it remains in my mind, is that there's a responsibility to the victims. And that there are a lot of victims in my book. And you want to not be saying things like, well, you know, not all the German soldiers were Nazis, not all the German fighter pilots were Nazis. And that thread has passed right the way through the history of the Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
So we get into this idea of the clouds again. The problem with those arguments is when you say, let's make that soldier exceptional and that airman exceptional and that sailor exceptional, is you're forgetting that they're all part of a criminal organization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm not going to go down the route of saying Germany was this mafia state that Hitler ran like things like the Godfather and all that, because it didn't. It was a very, very civilized nation, even though it's committing genocide, which is, you know, the dichotomy of this whole sodding business with the Nazis. They are standing behind civilization and committing the most heinous crimes. And for me, to a certain extent, you know, you have to cut through the military history and the nationalistic exceptionalism and what have you, and say not only was civilization being challenged, but it was actually being deconstructed. And when you pick on a community, as the Nazis did with the Jews or with the Sinti Romani,
mm-hmm.
and isolate them and start killing them, you're going beyond the culture war of Bismarck and the horrors that he committed in the 19th century, and you're getting down into now something really, really very ugly. And that has a bearing on humanity and human societies. So, you know, for me, the Holocaust isn't, and the Second World War, the way I look, read them, they're not, oh, let's draw a few lessons from history and not kill Jews and not kill this and not kill that. It's the whole kit and caboodle of how civilized nations should or should not behave. And what happens with the Nazis, and, you know, I can discuss this if we continue, mm-hmm. when we look at this Polish forest, the Polish forest is brought in within German law. And because it's within German law, they want to commit crimes but not break German law, which is such a madness in the thinking process. But yet you could go through the same, you can actually see the same kind of processes going on when, I don't know, a nation decides it's going to invade a neighbour because it doesn't like them, as has happened with Putin and Ukraine, or what we did in, and I never supported it. The idea that you can somehow bomb the Serbians away from killing the Croatians, that actually is making it worse, because you're just tippling bombs all over a mm-hmm. population and hoping that they're going to respond to it. Now, I know, you know, some American listeners and Royal Air Force listeners will say, well, you're being naughty, you shouldn't say that. NATO was trying to save people. I don't think you can save people by bombing them. The job is much harder.
We say a lot that, and I sometimes remind my coworkers about this, that the Air Force isn't used to fight and win a war. The Air Force is used in conjunction with ground forces, because you cannot project power with the Air Force alone. You need boots on the ground and be able to manage the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I had a, as you do, I had a long conversation once with a B-52 pilot. I happen to like the aircraft, and one day I was at Mildenhall at an air show and watching one of these things take off and the wings were bending, and he's telling me all about that. And I kept saying to him, don't the bombs fall off? And he said, you can't imagine how much care we take for bombs not to fall off and hit people, innocent or otherwise, and that we go through a great process of trying to minimise and control the damage we're doing. And I thought that's a very interesting conversation. Okay, we know B-52s were used in Vietnam and Cambodia and all these other places, and we know that Flying Fortresses bombed Schweinfurt and there was troubles with all of that. I know all of that story, but there's still an intent in the mind of that airman that the Luftwaffe never had. Yeah, I know it sounds crazy, but for the Luftwaffe to consider showing mercy, you know, you've got more chance of winning the lottery. Because from the moment they bombed Guernica, the whole mindset was destruction. Mm-hmm. So Guernica was in Spain in 36, 37. The whole mindset is destruction. And if they could use aircraft to destroy a village and it killed all the partisans in it, all the Russian soldiers, well, they wouldn't do it once, they'd do it twice. I didn't care how many civilians, which is why you get that aggressive bombing of tactical air force in Warsaw and Rotterdam. You know, it's tactical air force used to cause maximum social damage in a very, very brutal way. Okay, we know that the Royal Air Force does what it does in the Second World War, and for a long time it does some outrageous things, including Dresden and Hamburg, neither of which I can agree with. But, you know, they were part of a strategic game, and you can see there's always going to be those exceptions which are going to be worse than at any other time. And I'm not justifying it. It's just saying that that's what happens in war. And war, when it's unleashed, like the war that Hitler was unleashing, there is no mercy. And there's never, ever going to be any mercy. What we're talking about now in 1943 is all of those supposedly nice, clean airmen, those nice German soldiers, are turning into actual brutal fiends. And this is the period when they're conditioned into such horrific violence. It might surprise people to know that it continued after the war. Many German soldiers found it very difficult to settle after the war because they'd been so brutalized into committing violence, socialized into committing violence. And when many German soldiers came back in the 1950s, there was an upsurge of violence against the person, because they just couldn't get from, there was no way of breaking the bubble. And if you talk to older soldiers who'd, you know, been through the process, they all see the first 2 years as, yeah, you know, blitzkrieg, we're running here, running there. Some of our guys are dying, but we're basically winning. The British run away, the French run away, all's good. That doesn't happen after 1943. And nearly all of them are saying, we're in these brutal fights, we're getting wounded, we're going back to the fight, and that's where we are. You've decided... You've decided to discuss a subject which is probably quite unpleasant, because
it's okay. It's this is, like I said,
something I just want to add, this is the time in 1943, and we should mention it, that places like Treblinka really ante up the extermination process. So you've actually got, you know, there's millions dying on the battlefield. There's millions dying in camps, not extermination camps. There's millions dying in slave labor. So the actual tranche, you know, the actual process of violence across the whole of this regime is tumultuous. It's like an apocalypse of violence everywhere. You know, if you went down the road and you went to the factory where they were building half tracks here in Aachen, 90% of the workers there were Russian females. Now, somewhere between 1941 and 1945, 148 of those women died and are buried in one of the cemeteries there. And, you know, they were kept in a camp in the center of town. So, you know, you might be working in a local community and you go to work and there's a camp with Russian laborers just by the side of the road. You go to another side of the road and there's a ghetto full of Jews who are waiting to be deported to Auschwitz or Treblinka. And they're in another building and they're in your space. And at the same time, you're being bombed by the Royal Air Force. And at the same time, you're getting messages that your loved ones are being killed in Stalingrad or in Africa. So, you know, the stretch of violence that's impacting on Nazi Germany by March 1943 is quite horrendous.
I know that there's, especially in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, there's more research to suggest that the idea of, like, I don't want to say clean, but a clean Wehrmacht and a, you know, like, and that maybe some of the people didn't actually know what was going on, that those are more myths than they were, than reality. And that it's not like an international court could try and convict literally everybody, you know? So I understand that there were some kind of compromises that after the war we made, but it's hard to, it is definitely a difficult subject. And when you think of the numbers of people that are being killed and how they're not just soldiers and that these people are being kept in just towns where life is still going on around them while they're still being bombarded by the Royal Air Force and the American Air Force, the Army Air Force. It's even with a great imagination, it's hard to really appreciate how much is involved in this, like, this overall picture, you know?
Yeah, Aachen was one of the first cities, well, it was the first German city to be occupied by any of the Allied forces, Russian, British, American, or Canadian. And the Americans tried an experiment here, and it's going to be a future book of mine, but the experiment was to actually try to exorcise out the Nazi germ, if you like, from the population.
After the war?
Yeah. Actually started in November 1944 while the war's going on. So you've got this unusual situation of a German community denazified while the war's coming to an end. And it was a shock because initially, the Americans thought it's only the senior people who are running the city, the Lord Mayor, the Oberbürgermeister, the various other mayors and all the other people who were the Nazis. What they hadn't realised and what they couldn't contend with, the fact that ordinary folk believed in the Führer and continued to believe in the Führer, some of them even beyond the end of the war, which is a remarkable notion for any of us to understand. And of course, because the end of the war is not joined up to the war fighting, it's missed in the military history. So we come away thinking, well, there's Stalingrad, there's the Battle of Britain, there's Normandy, we've won the war, we've walked away, and isn't that good of us? But what everybody misses, or has missed up until now, is how the occupation went to 1950, and why. Because although the British and the Americans are conducting the airlift, I can assure you, there were courts going on in Aachen, who were trying people who committed crimes against Jews and against other people. And those trials were taking place because the British and the Americans believed that the Germans needed a sense of social justice. And the only way you could conduct a form of social justice was to show them the crimes they had committed and then punish them.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't heavy punishments. It was to go through a legal process, which they'd never had, you know, for almost since Weimar times. So you had to reconstruct a sense of responsibility and guilt for crimes. And, you know, the two American airmen were shot down in 44 in Aachen, and they were badly stoned by women. And when they got to the police station, they were beaten up. And one of them had a fractured skull and the other one had a broken leg. Now, a Luftwaffe man came and collected them and took them away. And according to the two airmen, they were protected. Now, in 1947-48, that was a war crimes trial here in Aachen. You could say the Luftwaffe man saved them. It's possible he did. But what the British putting these men on trial did was to put all these people up before the courts and say, OK, you were one of the stoners at the age of 15. You were just a young girl at that stage. We're going to let you go. But if we see any more of this, you're in serious court and your past misdemeanors will be attached and you'll have up to 20 years in prison. Now, those were odd things because the Germans had never experienced that under the Nazis. Because they'd been extolled in 1943 to destroy the Terrorflieger, which is why you get these lynchings and killings starting to emerge in German cities. And here's a remarkable point. In 1940, Aachen is one of the first cities bombed because it's so close. It allows the British bombers to come in and bomb the place. And there's a very famous American historian, William Scherer, in the
Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, yeah.
He was actually in a hotel in Aachen watching the British aircraft come over trying to bomb him. And at the same time, he was recording these German officers and their ladies of the night running out of the hotel in their less than, you know, well-dressed natures. And he's writing all of this down and watching what's going on and how remarkable it is. Now, a month later, a crew was shot down over Aachen and they were given full military honours. And they were buried in the Aachen military cemetery. Everything was... And everything was hunky-dory.
Yeah. Oh. I'm just going to mute myself.
Okay. So you get this situation where 40, 41, there is honour in war, even though the British are bombing Germany. Come 1943, when the British try to burn Aachen to the ground in a, you know, one of those storms, firestorms. It's actually a week before the attack on Hamburg, and they tried to do what they're going to do in Hamburg. The only problem is that Aachen's old wooden community was surrounded by solid constructions, and it confined the fire to a small part of the centre of the city. Now, many of the crews that were shot down suffered very badly at the hands of the Germans, and the Germans made the dead from the bombing into a ceremony and said these... So they were no longer civilians, they were people fighting for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
So you have civilians for the very first time being buried in a military cemetery in Germany. Now, under the military code, you wouldn't do that.
Right.
They're doing it in 43 and they do it again in 44 and it's heavily politicized. So what you're seeing is a shift. So again, violence is being taken on board by the Nazis and then hammered back into the people in the form of, you know, superannuated, if you like, politicization. They're making the dead, in a way, if you like, the reason why you have to keep fighting. So, okay, you've lost your grandparents, your children, your mother, your father. You're still around. You can fight for the Führer. And what we will do is we'll put you in a house and we'll give you Jewish furniture because the Jews don't need it anymore because we've murdered them. And you can have all this furniture and you can go and live in a nice house. And the people say, isn't that nice of him? You see?
Yeah.
You're buying, in a sense, you're transferring victims to victims with victim stuff. And, you know, it really is it's such an unpleasant dynamic for people to consider that it appalls. And that's why I don't have any problem with the British and the Americans and the Russians come to that, fighting as hard as they do to destroy Nazi Germany. Irrespective of what the Russians are doing now,
right?
You know, the three nations, plus Canada and France and the others, had to get rid of this thing. And as we've seen in subsequent years, sinews from that disease that was, you know, we thought we got rid of this pandemic called Nazism, still linger. It's like COVID. It never really goes away. There's bits of it still coming around and fester into some ugliness. And we see, you know, forms of it. Okay, it's a different form, but it's a similar kind of use of violence for political ends. And the violence is brutal and harsh. And it has no limit. And that's outside of the context of our thinking of military history and why soldiers fight and why we need soldiers to fight. And that's what we forget. We need soldiers to learn to understand how imperative it is to fight for democracy and Western values, just as the soldiers had back in the 1940s. I don't think any British or American soldier went into the Second World War thinking, what the hell am I doing? I think they knew. And I think as the closer they got to the extermination camps and the more they saw the violence, the more they realized what they were doing was for the benefit of mankind.
It was such a, I don't even know how to describe it. Like it was, the problem was so deep in Europe, but it was going to affect all of the world. And so everybody had to, I mean, and we see it even in 1943, we still have countries that are jumping onto this. Now we're declaring war against Germany. Countries in South America declaring war on Nazi Germany in 1943, you know, it's like three, four years into the war.
But I think people were also beginning to see things like the reports that Karski brought from Poland.
Yeah.
And they saw the scale of the horror that was taking place. So, you know, back in November 1942, you've had Anthony Eden give his speech in the Houses of Parliament about what the Nazis are doing against the Jews of Europe. You also get Roosevelt picking up on this and the American government, and it's uncomfortable. They don't immediately, anybody doesn't immediately jump to the idea that they're fighting a war for Jewish freedom. That's not what happens. But what people do realize is that what Hitler and his gang have done has to be stopped for the benefit of humanity. Now we know that Stalin and Mao and these people continued on with their versions of similar forms of violence, and you know there's no taking away from it. But what Hitler's gang was prepared to do was to take that level of violence beyond the borders of his own country and export it everywhere else. There was no limit to his ambitions. That's why it had to stop. And I think, okay, people say Churchill got wise to it from the beginning. I think a lot of people were wise from it from the beginning. It's just that Churchill wrote himself into the story as the, you know, I knew all of this and what have you. All that stuff doesn't really work for me, I'm afraid. I think he manipulated stuff and what have you. But anyway, bye-bye. That's what politicians do. I think the soldiers, British and American soldiers, Canadian soldiers, Russian soldiers, deserve the recognition we give them. But at the same time, I'm not going to say that the wars that they fight with their, you know, within the realms of flags on maps type military history is good enough. Because we have to know what's also going on with Allied soldiers. And not all of it's good.
No, it's not. I think at least two other guests later this year that are going to talk about some of the problems and war crimes, at least Americans, maybe allied to. So not just the bad guys. We have some of our own nasty stories too.
Yeah, war does that. But what we've tended to do is airbrush out our side of the nasty to make us look super cool.
Yeah, just apply an Instagram filter. We're good.
Yeah, I can understand that. Unfortunately, there's people like me who wander around and put the history back. And that doesn't always sit happily with even relatives. Look at me and say, what on earth are you doing? And I said, because I want to see the general picture so everybody understands where we're at.
Yeah. No, I would much rather cover the facts than to cover a whitewashed fairy tale version of the history. I want people to see the full story.
Well, I'm not going to mention any names because I can't stand the guy. but there is one denialist of the Holocaust who you may or may not have heard of, but I'm not going to mention his name. Mm-hmm. Now, during the 70s and 80s, his history books were well supported by many of the world's leading academics, and he was regarded as the foremost historian of this, that, and the other, without actually having any historical qualifications that were worth or valid. And a lot of what he wrote, and this might surprise you, a lot of what he wrote is still in the collective narrative of the war. Now, I have seen modern popular historians make statements about the war that denialist made in the 70s and 80s. And this is a danger we're in when we don't fully tell the story and we don't respect the victims and we don't treat military history correctly. And then we're left with the historians, the archaeologists, the anthropologists of the other fields to come along and say, well, actually, we're telling the real story is this. And because those stories are not always popular, they also get swept away. And my concern is what we're doing in what's happened in military history, which is why there's this, you know, this constant reference to cleanliness of the Wehrmacht, which, you know, has to be the most absurd idea ever to come out of that war, because the war criminals have sold their tales as honorable people and everybody's bought it. I mean, it's the biggest financial process ever, and nobody's really understood that when the SS were running their welfare operations by 1943, because they had all these divisions and troops going everywhere and what have you, they started to build up a welfare system, okay? So, you know, I'm still on your page for 1943, but I'm just talking about another
one. No, go ahead.
So, you know, these butter wouldn't melt in our mouths SS men roaming around, murdering people right, left and centre, but totally misunderstood because really they were nice guys.
Of course.
We're building up this huge heritage on the wealth of the war, right? So that's the first thing that they're doing. They're squirreling that money away. The second thing they do is they build this kind of courageous story that they were fighting a crusade against Bolshevism, which obviously came into Cold War logic with McCarthyism and all the good stuff going on in America and in Britain. And to a certain extent, if you read some of Churchill's stuff, he's saying, you know, there's an iron wall coming down and we've got to fight the bear and blah, blah. A lot of that stuff was good old SS Nazi propaganda rubbish, right? Which had filtered into the Western thinking, which is why you get this crazy moment in the war when as German soldiers are being captured, they're asking their captors, like the British and the Americans, can we all get together now and fight the Russians, which is a totally absurd idea. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we'll stop winning and we'll just join you lot and then we're all finished. But anyway, all of this stuff came together. And come the end of the war, many of the SS men, there are a few fall guys, but you have to understand how Nazi social Darwinism worked and how the SS version and the Luftwaffe version of this worked. So you have a few fall guys, right? Those fall guys go into the courts and say, yeah, I was a mass murderer, blah, blah, blah. What nobody ever traced was how their relatives were well looked after by the old boys associations. So you get publication service coming out of the war, funds, the pension funds, right?
Yeah.
So you get all this fan literature and you look at the people who are behind it and the publishers, because, you know, I'm the person who interrogates the copyright page. Other people are reading the contents. I'm reading who's written this bloody thing. Yeah?
And who's supporting
this? Who's financing it and going on. And when you start tying up all of those ends, it's a really different story. When you think that I had about 14 relatives fight in the Second World War, of which five of them were very grievously wounded. They didn't get military pensions until they went over 65. The criminals that I've had to deal with, and I know them by name because they actually boasted in their reports that they shot this Jew, that Jew, and all these other Jews, they were getting pensions from 1952, right? They were getting solid pensions. And they were going back to their old jobs. Or they were put on training schemes to go to decent jobs.
Like a Nazi rehabilitation.
And if you looked at some of the senior SS men who escaped justice, one in particular I know very well, a guy called Werner Best, he ran a legal service to defend after 1960. So they go right the way through the 50s, letting their old boys getting hung, but making sure that the families are looked after. You get Eichmann. Look at the case of Eichmann. Yeah, he's the fall guy for the SS. Oh, it's all down to me, and I didn't know what I was doing, and, you know, you've got all this evidence, but you'll never really understand me. He's executed in Israel, and the story kind of drops away. There's a couple of trials here and there, the Auschwitz trial, Treblinka, in Germany, and Franz Stangl goes to court, and he's put in prison for life and what have you. But the vast bulk escape, and that happens the same with the Luftwaffe. And if you look at who was publishing, and how they were publishing, and where they were publishing, and who the readerships were, you can see the game. And the game was almost a copyright of what happened after the end of the First World War, when all these German books came out referring to a lost cause. You know, von Richthofen was a great hero. Here's the lost cause of, we should have won the war. We were never defeated. All that
stabbed in the back.
All that dire nonsense now got regurgitated into virtually the same formats for the Second World War. So you've got books by Adolf Garland, and I'm not convinced he actually sat down and wrote it. I'm very surprised he could have done. He writes a book called The First and the Last, which if you compare it to von Richthofen's book from, you know, 1917 or thereabouts, they're almost parallel. And that's because they're written to a format and then they're marketed. And the same happens with the, you know, with the SS divisions. I mean, the most remarkable thing that I've seen is just how many books there are on a certain SS division. I'm not going to mention its name because I'm just not. But on SS division, I think they've had 12 books published about them in the last 2 years. And it's the same stuff regurgitated. What they don't know is everybody buying some of that content, where the copyrights and the royalties go back, are basically funding an old boys association. And it was very sophisticated. I mean, I met it in 1979. I was in Saarbrücken and I met a bunch of SS guys, and they introduced me to all the various things that were going on. They gave me a copy of their journal. They gave me a tankard of the local panzer battalion who supported them in the Bundeswehr, right? And they all had their own names on tankards, which this panzer battalion had offered them. I'm not going to mention that either. But the point is, there was a process of funding there.
Yeah.
And it was huge. And that sustained the story that we have, which is, you know, nearly all of those books, 1943 disappears into a kind of, well, you know, Stalingrad happened. And then we came along and we were fighting hard in Normandy, and then we were defeated by the mass of the Russians coming up. And it's the same narrative. It's the same agendas. It's the same nonsense. And hence why I've gone down the route I've gone down, which is to write books which look at the real side of the German war and what the German soldiers are doing. And yeah, before I realized the nature of the word clean, I actually used it in Birds of Prey to talk about the myth of the clean Luftwaffe. I think today I wouldn't use it.
So since you wrote Birds of Prey, which was new, I mean, 2021, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the last couple of years, you've learned more.
No, I've just decided that
The phrasing
isn't correct. If I could rewrite that word, I would say the myth of the Luftwaffe. I'd take the clean out, because the clean is unnecessary, because it was never clean. So to be clean, to even suggest there was a myth of cleanliness, there had to be something clean, and there never was. So it's irrelevant. It's just the use of the word that I don't feel so comfortable with it. And I think sometimes authors who may have gone into something in a kind of hasty or rash, or not really fully contemplated the meaning of the word, sometimes they have to hold their hands up and say, yeah, I kind of made that mistake on that one.
I think part of it too is that a lot of the people who perpetuate that myth, not just with the Luftwaffe, but with the Wehrmacht as well, it's they come from cultures like ours. And we want to see that, you know, not there's no way that everybody could be bad, right? I mean, there must be something there that we can make it understood through our lens. And at least maybe part of it might be that.
Shall I tell you two ludicrous stories?
Sure.
Okay. I know you like them.
I do like them.
So Adolf Garland gets the job of top general of fighters after Mulders is killed in an accident. Mulders was coming to Udet's. Udet had been Goering's friend. He committed suicide in 1941. And Mulders was coming over, and he died in an accident, I think afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
He was flying away. His aircraft struck a chimney and was killed. So Garland is given the job of being general of fighters. Now, two things arise from that. One, how long did he spend in the Eastern Front? No record, because we know 1945, most of the Luftwaffe records, especially the fighting units, were all destroyed because the Luftwaffe mm-hmm. destroyed them. And to me, of all the archives, they're the ones who are deliberately destroyed. And what does that tell you? Why can I have more SS archive than I can Luftwaffe archive? There could be some reason there. Yeah, something's very dodgy.
Yeah.
So when I did my research on Garland, of which people say, well, you know, I don't spend an awful lot of time going on about his shooting down this person or shooting down that person. That's simply because he deceived us into believing that's the only thing he did. Now, by chance, I fell on the idea of examining the hunting. As a sport and pastime, you know, wild game hunting, shooting stags and lions and wildebeests and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in one journal, right at the time when Galland has just been made general, there is a story of him hunting in the East. Now, what's fascinating by the story is not so much the fact that he confronts partisans and shoots one without actually asking, are you a Russian partisan or are you a local partisan who's against the Russians? He just shot him, right? Which in itself is odd. But the second thing is, he's in the forest where 10,000 Jews are being murdered. And I sat and thought, that's just beyond coincidence, okay? Now, none of that story entered into the book First and the Last. Back in the late 90s, when I was researching for my PhD and for the book Hitler's Bandit Hunters, I met a very famous lady called Gita Sereni. She has now sadly passed. But she wrote a lot about her engagements of discussing and meeting certain individuals, and she confronted Albert Speer and Franz Stangl. Franz Stangl was the Nazi commandant of Treblinka. She broke him down and she broke Speer down. The thing about Gita is she was this kind of lady who was relentless in finding the truth. So she went and chatted with Adolf Galland. Now, I can tell you now, Galland was the most arrogant man of all of the Luftwaffe generals I've ever come across. And he signed two pictures of mine, and I spent money buying those pictures. But I can assure you, I thought he was the most arrogant man I've ever come across. Gita Sereni says to him, "So what was it like to be with Speer?" And he sits there and pours it all out, because first of all, he's not talking to an airman. So he doesn't think, oh, she's got no story to tell.
Yeah.
And soon as I've told the Royal Air Force, the United States Air Force, that we were never involved in the Holocaust, genocide or Nazi crimes, and I told Guy Hamilton, the film director of the Battle of Britain, that we never did Nazi salutes, it doesn't matter what I say to this old lady because she has no relevance to me. So he sits and talks about being in an aeroplane with Heinrich Himmler, Albert Speer, flying over Auschwitz in March 1942, and they look outside the window, and Himmler says, "There's only 20,000 left." Okay, how did you not know about the Holocaust when you're sat with a dude who's the architect and he's telling you what's happening?
Yeah.
So there's that confrontation between history and fact, and the fact that he had gone out of his way to try and censor himself and the story and erase it from the record. And just by picking up some diverse sources, we were able to build him up and put him into places. And then, of course, at the latter part of the war, he created this handbook where the pilots only had to look at the cartoons to know what the hell they were talking about, because we got to the stage now. You've just got to get the guys in the air and shoot down flying fortresses. So he gets Troutloff to write, who's another one of these great aces, to do these cartoons. And, you know, they're pretty naff. Mostly based on hunting, because hunting is the honour code that binds all the Luftwaffe officers together. And it's under Goering's estate to rule his kingdom through the hunt. I know that sounds bizarre. We can talk about it later. But the point is, Troutloff does these cartoons with hunting, where you're showing how to kill an elephant at so many paces with certain bullet in the right place, as opposed to just firing off all your bullets. In other words, if you're a fighter pilot and you're coming up against a flying fortress, which is as big as an elephant, you don't just fire all your bullets at it, because you'll waste it and you won't have any effect. Troutloff in the corner of a picture of a B-17 blowing up, crashing after it's been shot down, has a little bubble with a caricature of a Jew with a pot of gold. Why? It serves no other purpose than to signify that if you destroyed that flying fortress, you destroyed Jewish money-making. You can't get any more Nazi than having that kind of deep thinking of how you're going to get across your message of what this war's about. So for someone to tell me the Luftwaffe wasn't fighting to destroy, quote, European Jewry or world Jewry, is utterly mistaken, because it was actually written into the battle instructions and training manuals. That's just piecing bits together. So here's another one.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
So the division that I won't mention was made up of men from another division that I won't mention, but they were all at the heart of Hitler's bodyguard. So I'm sure you know who I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in this gang, there was a man called Sepp Dietrichs, a man called Fritz Witt, and there was a man called Kurt Meyer. Now, what people don't know is those three dudes ran a colony round Lichterfelder, which became the SS colony. These guys became very deep amongst themselves, and the SS lavished them. Himmler made sure these people got everything. So they had the beautiful uniforms from Hugo Boss. They had all the armbands. They had all the medals. And they had what they call the death ring, the Totenkopf ring, to show that they were part of a family. And they all went to race school, where they learnt about racial extermination. And as a group of dudes, they killed their mates in the Sturmabteilung, which everybody forgets in the story of those two horrible SS divisions. In 1934, when Hitler decided to get rid of Ernst Röhm, they also got rid of a whole load of SA leaders and SS men who were inconvenient because they wanted the job. So you got all these hardcore SS men killing their own. And they go around saying, "We can never, ever talk about it." And they don't. Okay, it's the one secret. I mean, the SS, they'll talk about Auschwitz, they'll talk about Treblinka, they'll talk about Chelmno, they'll talk about how they gas people, they'll talk about how they put people into a pit in the sardine packing method. They will tell people how they kill people up close, far away, how they do it this way, that way, and every other way. They create 2,000 methods of killing people in Auschwitz, and they use every kind of practice you can imagine. But the one thing they don't talk about is killing Ernst Röhm and the gang. Why? Why? It's because basically it exposes what social Darwinism is about. Nazi social Darwinism is about, if you don't do what I like, the way we want it done, we kill you. So there's no negotiation to change your position. There's no, let's promote this guy upwards because he's actually quite useless, or let's get him out of the system because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. We kill you. Dead. No messing. It's what we do. We are professional killers. So a little time after the war, one of these chaps who ends up in a Canadian prison, Kurt Meyer, and I could explain in detail, if you want the detail, how those Canadian and British soldiers were murdered deliberately and with malice aforethought, because I've actually tracked every grave. But digress for a minute and just go to the book. They produce a book called Grenadier, which is part of this, you know, save the men, save the community, save the comrades, give money for the family. And they create a story which is all lies. And in this story, they determine to create the story of a certain German tank man, a name who you may or may not have heard of, called Wittmann. Now, up until that point, in 1960, I think it was, Wittmann was nobody, hadn't done anything. And now they suddenly create this hero who gets embellished and embellished, and I mean, it's gone crazy. Now, where does that story lead? Well, what it leads to is you actually recreate in military history a false character who had none of the impact he had, but the old boy network are using it to generate a story which had no basis, but which to cover the real truth of what the SS was about. Now, here's two stories about that regiment and division that you might like to find funny. Well, in 1943, so we're back to 43 now, that regiment, that division in Berlin Liebestandarte was asked by Berlin, by the Berlin Ballet, if they could supply troops for the ballet. The Waffen-SS were in tutus and ballet slippers dancing around the stage.
Did they actually have dancers, or were that they pulled from the ranks?
They were pulled from the ranks. The reserve battalion starred in Swan Lake or whatever. It's a piece of the story they don't like telling.
Yeah.
Oh no, that wasn't ours. Now here's the second story, which you might like.
Yeah.
So you got Wittmann, who goes into this battle in Normandy, and everyone says how great he is and all the rest of it. And you got Meyer, who has to take command of this division because his commander has stood in an area where he's been killed by Royal Navy artillery. So Here's the thing. Meyer's never commanded a panzer division, and he's only ever been trained to be a grenadier regiment commander. So on the learning curve, he's way, way below what he should be. The commander, who's supposed to be the god of all the commanders, has been killed by naval fire. And you have to ask the question, why was he in a position where he would be destroyed by naval fire? And the third is, why is this chap, this tank commander, so highly regarded, being out in the middle of an attack by a British regiment and then hightailing it back after his tank's been destroyed to report to his command? Well, suddenly you've got questions and conundrum, because it's the story that we've been told is this division and these tankers have held up Montgomery and the line, and they're still there in whenever, August, and it's all been a disaster because these three men have fought very hard, or four men have fought very hard and put these divisions against the line. When you come down to it, That's not the case at all. If Wittmann hadn't run, they wouldn't have known what they were doing, because they had no outriders, they had no advance parties, they hadn't set themselves up to take in information of where the Allies were. They didn't actually know. And because of the intensity of the Allied operations, they had no way of sending signals. Because if they did send the signals, it would advertise where the headquarters were. And that's what's happened with Panzer Group West. It got absolutely destroyed by the air forces. The fact that a few weeks later, the famous tank man is seen roaming down the street, British and Canadian Shermans and maybe Typhoons blow him to pieces. You have to ask, who sent him down that street? Well, it's the Panzer Division commander, who doesn't understand really how to run a Panzer Division. He's had a great exercise of reducing his division, which at one point had 30,000 men and maybe 60, 90 tanks. He's turned that into a division of one tank and 1,500 men. And people say to me, that's effective leadership. Really? Well,
it doesn't seem that effective to
me. No. And this is what happens with the SS. They go into a battle, they get completely devastated, walk away saying, aren't we good? No, not really.
Well, we tried.
Pretty crappy, actually. You're the worst soldiers I've ever come across. And that's a complete story. And yet I still get people arguing with me saying, you don't know what you're talking about because you have. And I'm saying, just look at the stats, man. You're running your organization into the ground and you're not able to fight anymore. Yeah, but it comes refitted and it's refitted. Yeah, I said, how many times do you refit it before the whole thing collapses? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm boring you. You're
No, you're not boring me.
I bored you and you got found out being bored.
I am not bored.
I'm not going to let it go. Not in the act of being bored.
Look, I'm going to say like this. Just falling asleep.
Yeah. Folks, he's falling asleep. I'm sorry.
Every now and then, like, my face will drop. Tip
during the free time. So this has turned not into the way you wanted it to go, really, have you?
You know what? That's the best way. I do have to ask, because I don't know how to pronounce any of the Polish forest or any of that, so I don't even know how to steer us to that story. Yeah, let's talk about the Polish forest.
Do you want to have a break for a second? Grab a walk?
Sure.
That last bit was not really relevant to the overall story, but it was amusing to be accused by a guest of falling asleep, and I thought the listeners might enjoy that exchange. I will end this episode here, and we will pick up the second episode with Dr. Blood's talk of the Luftwaffe in Poland, in that forest that I still cannot pronounce correctly. Just a reminder that any views and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not reflect any official stances of the U.S. Army, the Combined Arms Center, the Center of Military History, the Department of Defense, or any other organization associated with me, my guests, or this series. Thank you for joining us today. MOT out.